I've said, I'm sure he'll write to you. Then I would put a letter on his, I'd put that on his desk. Then I'd prepare another letter to them for him to sign when he got back saying, I read your letter, I read Barry's reply, and I agree with what he said, and I've got nothing to add to it. And I'd, as I say to people, that facilitated things wonderfully. You know? And I don't think he ever knocked anything back that I said.
Again, because you knew what how he thought. And you thought along similar lines. And,
yeah.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. I wondered what you would do in a situation like that. And,
But a lot of, I can't really think of examples, but a lot of people would write in. One thing that caused a lot of trouble, I went on long service leave. After 10 years, I went on long service leave, and my wife and I and the kids went around Europe in a caravan. And while I was away, an economist fellow from the Trade Department filled in for me. And he was writing speeches for Doug, and he wrote a speech in which he suggested that we should have a flat rate of taxation. Everybody pays the same rate of tax. And Doug said this in the speech somewhere. Well, it caused a terrific uproar, especially from an organisation called the League of Rights, which you've probably heard of.
Yes.
And they had this theory that you should print money, you know, the banks could create as much money as they liked, and so on. And so I spent months then replying to all these letters from people all over Australia, you know, abusing Anthony for suggesting a flat rate of tax. I didn't think we should expect a department to handle things like that.
Were there occasions when in dealing with the media you were also in a situation where you weren't able to consult Doug and you would then have to play the role of representing him, so to speak?
Yes, there were. I think I was always very careful, though, in what I said. I did get into strife once. There was a fellow named Alan Barnes who represented The Age in the press gallery. I think Alan died afterwards. I was talking to him one day, and I think it might have been during an election campaign, and I don't know why, but I said something to the effect that working in coalition is difficult, which it is. I thought that was obvious, you know. And it was something like that. It was, you know, working in a coalition is difficult. And Alan published this in his story, and the next thing, Fraser was on the phone, going mad. He said, "Why on earth did you say that?" You know, and went on and on. Anyway, that's one time I got into strife. He said, "You better get him to do something about it." So I went and said to Alan, I said, "Oh, look, I'm in trouble. I said, Fraser's been on to me." And so he pulled it out of the next edition of the paper, which I thought was very good of him. Mm-hmm. You know, he did that. Well, you're all the time talking to the media. You know, they'd be ringing up at home and so on. And usually it was just factual stuff that I would give them. There was only one occasion that I can remember when I put out a press statement without Doug having seen it. And he was, I don't know where he was, he was in Australia, but he wasn't here. Paul Keating, we're in government. Paul Keating, Doug was in favour of import parity pricing of oil. Oil and petrol were very cheap in Australia. And he was persuaded that we should pay the world price for oil. And he thought that would encourage oil exploration in Australia. It might help change people's consumption patterns. You know, motorists would be a bit more careful about using fuel and so on. And this argument went on for a long time. Paul Keating said something. I can't even remember what it was. But I sort of took umbrage to it. So I wrote a press statement refuting, I thought, what Keating had said. And I couldn't get in touch with Doug. So I just put it out. And that was the only time I ever did that. When he did see it, he said, "That's all right, you know." but I think that was about the only time I ever did it.
You've mentioned the part of the building in which you were based, or different offices at different times. To what extent did you need to move around the entire building? Like, were there other spaces that were necessary for your work?
Well, I go to the library quite often, obviously, even just looking at newspapers or you know, doing a bit of research or things like that. I remember once, when we lived in Lismore, we used to go up to Brisbane occasionally, just for the day. And I remember we went to Brisbane once, just for the day. This is long before I worked for Doug.
Yep.
And we went to the movies at the old Regent Theatre. There was a Wurlitzer organ there, and we were very keen on the Wurlitzer organ. And there was a newsreel on, and it showed Churchill being given an honorary degree somewhere. And I noticed that Churchill said, he said, I've always been surprised that at the number of honorary degrees I've received compared with the number of examinations I've passed. Because he was a very bad student, poor student, yeah. You know, but he had all these degrees. And that struck me. And years and years later, it must have been in the late 70s or early 80s, after Doug had been responsible for the development of CER, you know, closer economic relations with New Zealand, the Victoria University in Wellington said they wanted to give him an honorary degree in recognition of the work that he'd done. So I thought of what Churchill had said, and I went into the library and looked up the book of his speeches and found where he'd said it. It turns out he'd said it at quite a few universities. And I put that into Doug's speech, you know, and quoted Churchill and so on. But I spent a bit of time in there. You know, the dining rooms and so on. That's all.
What about the chambers? Did you have occasion?
Didn't go in there much. Occasionally I'd go in and sit in the advisor's seats, you know, if he was putting a bill through or something like that, or if he was acting PM, and which he did quite a lot, of course. But almost the whole period, I would go and stand in the press gallery for question time, which a lot of the press secretaries did, you know. But that was about it.
And the facilities available to staff, did you take advantage of them? What were they?
We used to play tennis occasionally over here in the reps garden. We used to play squash. Might have been before your time, but there were squash courts, which I think Doug had a hand in having built, in the reps garden, near the tennis courts, yeah. We used to go down to Manuka and play squash down there at a private squash courts. And I think he must have got sick of that, so he, next thing, some squash courts appeared in the reps garden, and we used to play there a lot. They were used a lot, but I don't think they're there now, are they? I think they're gone.
No, they're not there now.
Yeah.
Tennis still.
Mm.
Were there any areas in the building that were out of bounds?
I can't remember whether there were. I mean, we didn't go into the members' dining room or places like that, but I don't remember any areas specifically where they said, you know, don't go there.
Mm. And I guess you wouldn't have gone to the bar anyway.
No,
not thinking.
No. You know, I used to go to the non-members' dining room quite a bit. Mm.
I'm interested in the office equipment and technology. What was it like in 1964? How did it change over 20 years?
Well, when I came, we had telephones, of course, and typewriters, old manual typewriters. Then I think we got some electric typewriters. And when Doug succeeded McEwen, we inherited a typewriter from McEwen that had a big typeface on it, which they used for his speeches. So I thought that was a marvellous step forward in the technological sense, you know. And I used that for years. We didn't have computers or email or mobile phones, faxes, anything like that. I remember when we got our first photocopier, and it produced one page at a time, very slowly. You'd feed one page at a time. You'd lift the lid up and put the thing on you wanted to copy and copy that. Then you'd have to lift it up, take that out, put the next one in and so on. It produced copies on very smelly, slimy sort of paper.
I remember. Yeah. Chemical type paper,
wasn't
it? It would fade over time.
Yeah, that's right.
I remember right.
Oh, yeah. And then we got facsimile machines. And you remember them too. They sort of had they were like an old Edison phonograph, and they had a cylinder, and there was a slot in the cylinder, and you would slip the edge of the paper into the cylinder, and it would wrap around the cylinder, the paper you wanted to transmit, and then you'd switch it on. You'd ring up, and the people at the other end would switch their machine on, and then you'd switch yours on, and a little light would travel along as this cylinder went along, and it would scan the writing on the thing and send it over the phone to the other end.
To be honest, I didn't know about that type of fax machine.
Yeah, yeah. We used to have. You might remember that Doug used to, when he was acting Prime Minister at Christmas time, he would hire an old caravan and put it beside his beach house up at New Brighton, up north of Brunswick Heads, and he would run the country, so to speak, from there. And usually, we came from up that area, so we would go home, stay with our parents on both sides over that period, and each day I would drive down to New Brighton and sit in the caravan all day and answer the phone and deal with all the... They would send up bags of papers for him to deal with and that sort of thing. I tell people I like to think that I was running the country while he was out fishing, but that's not really true. That's not really true. But we had a fax there that we used to send a lot of stuff backwards and forwards. He was very friendly with Harry Miller, you know, the theatrical entrepreneur, Harry M. Miller.
Harry M. Miller.
And Harry used to be very helpful to us, especially around election time, because Harry knew everybody in the television industry, and he would get people to help us record our policy speeches, and all of which I wrote, you know, for all those years, and all the television commercials and so on. And one day Harry said, Doug, you want to get a word processor? Well, we'd never heard of a word processor, didn't know what they were. But anyway, we got one, but that's how we first got a word processor. We got one shortly after that.
And that would have been a big bulky
thing, yeah, no doubt. Yeah, as I recall, yes.
And very expensive, I guess.
Yeah. I remember the first computer I bought after I left here, it cost me $4,000, and it took the old floppy, you know, the really floppy disks. And you had every morning when you switched it on, you had to put in two floppy disks that had all the software and the word processing software on them. $4,000 it cost.
Mm. It was a lot.
It's in the tip down at Dalmeny, somewhere down the south coast now.
Yeah. I hope there's a museum of all that technology somewhere.
Yeah, I think so.
And you've talked about the office and how at one point there were eight people working together. What were the relationships like among the staff?
Oh, they were very good. Yeah, we all got on very well. And I think that's because of I hope it was because of the kind of people we were. But we did. We were all very, very friendly and got on well. I remember one of the private secretaries from the primary industry, when Doug was Minister for Primary Industry, they sent over John Christian. And I remember some of the newspapers ran little stories about Mr. Anthony having one of his staff as Mr. Christian and one was Mr. Virtue. And they thought that sort of gave all right, made something of that. Yeah.
And the working hours and the conditions of work, what anything to say about that?
Well, the conditions, I mean, they were good. Doug was a terrific fellow to work for. You know, you were just treated as one of the family. You really became one of the family. And he was a wonderful fellow to work for. The hours were very long, of course. And in those days, I think they were longer even than they are now.
Now, was that because of sittings going
for
a
while? Yeah, especially during sittings. You know, the Parliament, I remember one night Doug was putting the Commonwealth Electoral Bill through, I think, when he was Minister for the Interior. And I was sitting up in the press gallery, and at 4 o'clock in the morning, he sort of indicated to me to go home, which I did, and he was still there. But it was just ridiculous, the long hours they sat in those days. And that raises the question, of course, of the effect on your family.
That's right, yes.
And it was an extremely significant effect on the family, very hard for them. My wife still talks about it, and she remembers that people were ringing, you know, even when I was at home, I'd be in here all day. Say it was a sitting week. I'd be in here all day, go home and have dinner, and then come back until, you know, 11 o'clock or midnight. And often you'd get home and then the phone would ring and, you know, it'd be a journalist wanting to check something. And, of course, I was also involved in an enormous amount of travel. And I was away from home a lot because especially, well, from the beginning, and when he became deputy leader and then he became leader, of course, Doug was in demand from all of his party members to visit their electorates. And he did that all the time. He had to do that as a leader. And he was also involved in a lot of... It got far worse, of course, during election campaigns. They were extremely demanding. And he was also, of course, involved in quite a bit of overseas travel, particularly when he became Trade Minister. And I went on quite a few of those trips. So my wife was at home on her own. And she had no relations here, no family here. Fortunately, we had some very good friends who lived just across the street, who neighbours, and they sort of kept an eye on her. We met them through the church. And so she got through all right. But it's terribly hard on families. And, yeah.
And did you have children at that stage?
We didn't have children at the beginning. In fact, we were married for 19 years before we had our first child. And when we came here, we'd been married for about 10 years or so. And eventually, my wife became pregnant. We were in the office around there, the leader of the National Party's office, around in this corridor. This microphone can't see where I'm pointing, but you know where it is. When we discovered that Claire was pregnant, and Doug was in Mwillimbah. One day, long before this, I was driving him somewhere in my car, and we were driving along King's Avenue, and he suddenly said, Barry, have you ever thought about adopting a baby? And I said, no. I said, there's still a chance that we could have one of our own. And so we left it at that. And and then sometime later, I rang him in Mwillimbah and I said, you remember that day we were driving along King's Avenue and you asked me if we'd ever thought of adopting a baby? And I said, no, there's still a chance we could have one of our own. I said, well, we are. Well, he got terrifically excited. You know, he thought it was marvellous. I think he nearly fell off his chair up in Mwillimbah. Mm. And so it was great, you know. But we really felt part of the Anthony family. Mm. We used to go out to the baths, the swimming pool, Deakin, of a morning in the summertime, and all the Anthonys would be there, and their kids would be there, and we'd go for a swim with them and so on. Mm. But we spent a lot of time with them.
Tell me, you mentioned Harry M. Miller.
Yeah.
Did Doug Anthony ever mention how that friendship had originated?
I can't really think how it started. Harry had a farm somewhere, as well as his other things, and I think he sort of somehow got a bit interested in the Country Party. But I'm not sure how all that developed. Interesting thing, you know, Harry got into some strife. He had some ticketing agency, or he started some business that sold theatre tickets, and he got charged with something or other. I can't think what it was. Well, I won't try to guess, but it was something like fraud or something like that. I can't remember. And he finished up in Long Bay Jail, and he was there for some time. And Doug had an office in Sydney. It was on top of the old, I forget what it was, but we had this office in Sydney, and one day he came in and he said, oh, I've just been out to see Harry Miller. And well, he'd gone out to Long Bay Jail to visit him. And he was the Deputy Prime Minister, I think, at the time. And I thought that was... and somebody wrote to Malcolm... he didn't tell anybody. He didn't tell us that he was going. He just went and did it, and then he told us afterwards. And this got into the papers somehow or other. We didn't do it, but something appeared in the paper about Anthony going to visit Harry Miller. Somebody wrote to Fraser, who was the Prime Minister at the time, complaining that Anthony had gone to visit this criminal in jail, you know, and he shouldn't have done that. And Fraser sent the letter up to Doug and said, what do I say? And Doug gave it to me, and I drafted a reply for Fraser, in which he said he admired Doug Anthony for sticking to a friend who was in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And I presume Fraser sent that off. But that's the way that Doug saw it, you know, that Harry had been very good to him and he was a friend and he was in trouble, so he went and had a yarn to him, hadn't seen him. And he did that with a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
When Philip Lynch got into trouble when he was treasurer, I forget what all that was about, but Lynch was stood down from his job, Doug went to see him in Melbourne. I don't know whether any other ministers did, but Doug did. When Ian Sinclair was in strife over his father's estate, and he got into a lot of trouble, Doug ferociously defended him, you know, on television and in the house and so on. Peter Nixon got into strife over some meat export scandal, and Doug really defended him very strongly. There was a journalist in Melbourne named Ronald Anderson who published a sort of a weekly newsletter thing which went out to a lot of rural people and organisations. And we discovered he was dying of cancer. So when Doug was in Melbourne, he went out to this fellow's house out in the suburbs somewhere and called on him and had a yarn with him. I think that illustrates the kind of person he was. You know, he stuck to his mates and so on. Fraser, I've heard Fraser say, they gave Doug a big dinner in Lismore when it to mark his 25 years in Parliament, and Fraser went up for it and he said, you know, Doug Anthony is a very good fellow to have on your side in a fight. And I think he was right. Doug appeared to the public as laid back and a country bumpkin and all that. But he was a very tough character. In negotiations around a table, you know, he could be extremely tough. But most people didn't sort of see that side of him. Yeah.
A question I should have asked earlier on, but I overlooked it. Were you a bookish person? Did you read a lot?
No, not a lot, I don't think.
I was just wondering, as a speechwriter, you know...
Yeah, when I sort of came here and started writing speeches and so on, it really became a fairly consuming sort of a thing. Now that I think back about it. And of course I did it for 33 years, both here and after I left here and went to work for the Law Council of Australia. And I wrote a lot of speeches there for the president, and there were 13 different presidents in the 13 years I was there, and I wrote speeches for them. Of course, when you're writing speeches here, you haven't got a lot of time to think about it. You know, I've run courses and workshops and so on speech writing, and I say, you know, you've got to have an introduction and you've got to do this and have arguments and so on and conclusions. I said, of course, I never did that myself. I just used to have to put a bit of paper in the typewriter and just go at it hammer and tongs until it was finished, because it was always required in a hurry, usually required in a hurry. And there was very little time to do much research or to draw up a sort of a speech outline, or which the textbooks tell you to do, but we really didn't do that. And you'd find yourself typing speeches in aeroplanes or hotel lobbies or rooms or in the back seats of cars and so on. So it all had to be done fairly quickly.
Nonetheless, is there a particular speech that you're proud of that stands out among all the speeches?
I made a dreadful mistake a few years ago. I was contacted by somebody who said that they were working on a program that they hoped to sell to the ABC about the Country Party and the National Party. And I arranged to meet this bloke in Canberra, and I gave him a dozen or so of what I thought were important speeches that Doug had made. And he foolishly, I didn't make copies of them. And I haven't seen them since. That was years ago. I've got a lot of his speeches at home. Well, they were all good.
Yeah, I'm sure they were.
I just can't think offhand of any that sort of stand out. One election campaign, Fraser was to open the election in Melbourne, open the campaign in Melbourne, but he got sick. And which meant Doug had to go first, and he opened the campaign in Brisbane. So it was the National Party campaign, but of course it was really for the whole of the coalition that he was speaking. And it was a real rabble-rouser, you know. I thought that was a pretty good one. It was a real rabble-rouser. And he got a lot of comments afterwards, you know, telegrams and things from people saying what a terrific speech it was and so on. I can't remember what it was all about now, but it would have been the 75 election, I think.
Ah, yes.
You know, at the end of the Whitlam term. Mm.
Were the staff unionised at all?
Like no, staff, I don't think or? So. I had belonged, of course, to the Australian Journalist Association because I was a journalist before I came here. And I think I maintained that membership throughout. I didn't have to, but I thought it was just the right thing to do. And I thought it might help my relations with the press gallery and so on. So I just kept that up, I think, for the whole period. I also had belonged to the Journalist Association superannuation scheme. I'd started that in Lismore, and I remember when I finally retired or left here, and the time came to collect this superannuation money, I'd been to a financial advisor, and she'd advised me to buy such and such a shares, you know, and buy all these things. And then when I tried to get the money from the super fund, it took months and months and months to get it. By that time, the price of all these shares had gone up through the roof. You know, I would have made a fortune out of it. And I complained bitterly to the AJA about this and argued that they should compensate me for the loss that they'd caused me by the long delay. But they wouldn't accept that argument. In the end, they gave me compensation based on the interest I would have earned on the money or something or other. So we left it at that.
Is it possible to describe a typical day? Was there a typical day?
No, there weren't any typical days. But if we're in the office, the first thing I do in the morning would be go through all the newspapers, scan through all the newspapers, see if there's anything there we should deal with or respond to or
and
comment
what,
on.
What
or,
time of day would this be? What
oh,
would you come to
9 o'clock. I think 9 o'clock we came in. In the early days, Doug would arrive on his bike. When he was appointed Minister for the Interior, of course, he decided that it was a good idea to live in Canberra. And he lived here except during the school holidays when they would all go home to Moolumbar and live there. And he bought this folding bike and he would ride it in from Hughes, where they lived in Kent Street. And then at night time, they'd fold it up and put it in the back of a Commonwealth car to go home. But when we first arrived, he invited Claire, my wife, to come across one morning to have morning tea and to meet the other members of the staff. And she was sort of a bit nervous about finding her way, and she found herself driving around State Circle twice. And she said each time she went round, she overtook Doug on the bike. I said, why didn't you stop and ask him the way? And she said, oh, she was too shy to do that. She didn't want to do that. I'd be working on a speech or writing press releases, or a lot of the time, of course, was involved in writing answers to correspondence, dealing with correspondence. And we might have to hop in the car and go to the ABC and do an interview. Or we developed this thing. When he had to go and do an interview, I'd say, now, what's the message? I said, don't worry too much about what they ask you. What is the point that you want to get across? So he'd sit there or stand there and he'd say, well, the message is such and such. And he'd get that into his head. And then when he did the interview, he would answer the questions, of course, but he would make sure he got that point across because that was the central point of his message.
Well, what do you think of media performances now by politicians, you know, when they're interviewed on 7:30 Report or whatever?
Well, they're all right, I suppose. One thing that I have noticed... not on the 7:30 Report, but almost every politician who was interviewed, standing out in the courtyard or wherever they stand up at Parliament House, their staff, somebody from their staff is standing behind them, nodding at everything they say. You know, they agree, they nod. We never did that. We were standing behind the camera, well out of range. But it seems to be the thing these days that you've got to have somebody standing there nodding all the time. Which it's only a little thing, but it seems very strange to me.
When you mentioned, you know, being on message, like having that idea
yes.
that there's a particular point to convey that that's done today ad nauseum.
Oh, yeah.
Like they're constantly getting back to the key point and not really responding to
the internet. My wife and I were watching whatever it's called on ABC 24 last night, and they were interviewing a Labor member and a Liberal member about the current political situation with the Speaker and so on. And of course, every time the Labor member was asked a question, he said, "No, we're not going to waste time talking about that. Well, we want to talk about jobs and this and our infrastructure and so on." Every time he was asked, he hammered that thing. And Claire said, "You know, he's got the message or something or other."
But in that typical day at work, while you're here in this building working, what would you do for morning tea, afternoon tea, lunchtime? You know what?
I think we just had a cup of tea in the office. I don't ever remember going down to the dining room for a morning or afternoon tea. I used to eat down there quite a bit. But when I was talking to my colleague Paddy Daly the other night, she reminded me I used to go home a lot at lunchtime. First 3 years we lived in Northbourne Flats, and then when it became obvious we were going to be here a bit longer, and Doug became deputy leader and we knew he'd have some staff and I would probably have a job, we built a house out at Garran and we lived out there for over 30 years, I think. We live at Jerrabombra now. Our kids live out there and we look after the grandkids a lot, so we thought we might as well go out there and live too. So we've sort of got our own colony out there, you know. But I did go home quite a bit, but we'd eat down in the dining room just with a couple of the other staff members usually. Yeah.
And how
was it was called Hepatitis Hall in those days. I didn't call it that, of course, but I've heard other people call it that. Yeah.
And how would you travel, Barry, if you went home at lunchtime?
Oh, in my car. Yeah, I just used my car. Right. Mm.
And in the evening, would you still be here and eat or go?
No, I always went home for dinner if I was here. No, I always went home for dinner with Claire and the kids, of course. It was hard too, having to come back at 8 o'clock every night when the house was sitting. Mm. Yeah.
What about social clubs?
I can't remember any social clubs. There might have been something, but because I had a wife and family at home, I went home. And I don't think there was really any socialising amongst the staff. The people who were single and who lived in Sydney normally and were living in hostels and things, I'm sure they socialised, but I really didn't get involved in that very much.
No. Yeah. We've already talked about the impact of your work on the family life.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you want to say about that, elaborate in any way?
As I said, it was a very significant impact. And it's at our place, it's still being felt.
And what about contact with parliamentarians other than Doug Anthony? Did you have opportunity?
Yeah, there was quite a lot, especially when he was party leader and deputy leader. They were in and out all the time, and even if they didn't want to see him, they would sort of drop in and talk to us and so on. Mainly, of course, the country party members or the national party members. There was Bob King from Wimmera and Mac Holton. Doug and Mac Holton were great mates. Bruce Lloyd, who succeeded McEwen in Murray. Peter Nixon, he and Doug were very close, you know, throughout. Ian Sinclair, of course. Ian Robinson was in the adjoining electorate of Cowper, it was called. It adjoined Richmond, and they were involved a lot. John England, Ralph Hunt. After Doug retired, just before Christmas, it must have been 1983, Doug had all the staff over to their unit in Kingston for a Christmas dinner. And that night, when we were going home, he walked out of the car with Claire and me, and he said, "Will you come back in tomorrow morning?" And I said, "Oh, yes, all right." And I thought, you know, what's happening? And so we were sort of awake all night wondering what he was going to tell us. It dawned on us that what he was going to say. Anyway, we came back in the next morning and he said, "I want to hang my boots up." And that was when he decided to give out. Because he'd often said that his father, who was a minister in the Menzies government, he said he remember seeing his father sitting on the back benches, a sad, sick old man. And he said he was always determined he wasn't going to do that. He was going to get out, you know, at a younger age. And he did.
You mentioned being the, you know, we've talked about the press secretary years. I should have asked about your relationship with the press gallery. How much contact, physical contact, would you have with the people in the gallery?
There was quite a bit. I think the relationship worked quite well. You know, when I arrived and met various people, I said, well, you know, I've gone from the bush, I haven't had any experience of this kind of thing, you know, I'll hope I can sort of cope. And they were all very good, and they were all very good to me. So I think it worked all right.
Yeah. What was it like, I mean, the place in which the journalists worked in the building? Do you want to describe it?
Physically?
Yeah.
Oh, it was a rabbit warren. Yes, terrible. Just unbelievable. Yeah, people wouldn't believe it if they saw it and they realised that all the news that they read in the newspapers and saw on television and so on came from a rabbit warren.